The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Live from the Space Talk Radio Studios, it's The Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting live to four continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy, here's the founder and host of The Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, Space Show listeners. Welcome to this Friday morning program. Thank you for joining us and tuning in. We have a really exciting and special program today. I'm going to run through the announcements to maximize the time we have with our guest. If you would like to call the program, and the toll-free line will be open in about 10 minutes, that toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring until we can answer it. Then be patient until we bring you up on air to participate in the program. If you prefer email, it is dmlivings@yahoo.com, drspace@thespaceshow.com, or thespaceshow@gmail.com. And chat is Space Show Chat, all one word, and that will work with Instant Messenger, ICQ, or CompuServe. I'll skip the rest of the announcements. You know what they are. You've heard them all many, many times. I will do the hold the dates real quickly. AIAA, September 19th through the 21st. Transforming Space by the California Space Authority, November 29th through December 1st. The Personal Spaceflight Symposium, put on by New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, that's October 17th and 18th. XPRIZE Cup, Las Cruces, New Mexico, that's the 20th and 21st of October. The STAFE Conference by the University of New Mexico, February 11th through the 15th, and that's in Albuquerque. And then the second international conference, an exposition on science, engineering, and habitation in space with the second biennial space elevator workshop. That is March 25th through the 28th in Albuquerque. ISDC 2007, that's May 24th through the 28th in Dallas. Don't forget to check out our website, thespaceshow.com. The newsletter is there. Everything is archived. The Space Show store. And again, I stress the support the Space Show button. This is a big undertaking to do this program. We do look forward to your support and your contributions. And remember, the Space Show is fully deductible, tax deductible as a 501c3 business. So thank you in advance for your contributions. That brings us directly to our very special guest and program today. We are honored to have with us Dr. Harrison Schmidt. And I want to stress that his doctor is a doctor of science. He's not an MD doctor. He has a diverse experience as a geologist, pilot, astronaut, administrator, businessman, writer, and U.S. senator. He has his B.S. from Caltech, studied as a Fulbright scholar in Oslo, Norway, and he attended grad school at Harvard. His Ph.D. is in geology in 1964, and it's based on geological field studies in Norway. As a civilian, Dr. Schmidt received his Air Force jet pilot wings in 65 and Navy helicopter wings in 1967. He was selected for the Scientist Astronaut Program in 1965. He organized the lunar science training for the Apollo astronauts, represented the crews during the development of hardware and procedures for lunar surface exploration, and oversaw the final prep work on Apollo 11's lunar module design stage. After training as a backup lunar module pilot for Apollo 15, Schmidt served as a lunar module pilot for Apollo 17, the last Apollo mission to the moon. On December 11th of 1972, he landed in the valley of Taurus-Littrow as the only scientist and the last of 12 men to step on the moon. In 1975, after 2 years in managing NASA's Energy Program Office, he fulfilled a long-standing personal commitment by entering politics. He was elected in 76 and served a 6-year term in the U.S. Senate beginning in 1977. I can continue to read about his incredible accomplishments. His full bio will be on the website. I would certainly rather talk to him, but I will say he has a number of awards. He is currently the chairman of the NASA Advisory Council, a council that has been getting a lot of press lately. And above all, he has a book written in 2006. I have read this book. It is titled Return to the Moon. This is really a good book. And you know why it's good, everybody? It's because not only does he lay out a scenario of why we should return to the moon, he puts out the comprehensive plans of how you would do project management, how you might cost it out, how you might attract capital. Nobody does this. Nobody I've ever heard of has put out the kind of information that Dr. Schmidt has in the Return to the Moon book. And for the first two callers that call in with questions or comments for Dr. Schmidt after we open the toll-free line in about another 5 to 10 minutes, I have two books from his publisher to give away. As I said, they will go to the first two callers, only callers, no email. Dr. Schmidt, welcome to the Space Show. How are you today?
I'm great, and thank you so much for inviting me to speak with you.
Well, this is a true honor. Let's see. I guess I'd like to start out, and let's focus on your book, because we do have this program of going back to the moon. It's not well connected with the American people, but if we did something like you're talking about in your book, and we put out a scenario to go to the moon because it's going to help us with our energy problems, or there's value or commerce there, and we need to be there to operate and deal with these businesses, and there'll be a real payoff to taxpayers, even though you prefer doing this with the private sector, I think Americans would be much more behind this program than they are today. I don't think any Americans can tell why we want to go to the moon other than maybe to wave the flag again.
Well, David, you and I both recognize that the mainstream media does not cover this kind of information that would be important, I think, to the American electorate. They concentrate on the kinds of things they concentrate on, and that's what people generally will be aware of. Television and to an increasing degree, fortunately, radio is the primary way that Americans get their continuing education. And if things are not being covered, then it's hard for people to understand what the advantages to the taxpayer and to the American nation would be for a strong and vigorous space program. Fortunately, President Bush understands this. The Congress seems to understand it. They have supported his what's called a vision for space exploration. And I think the American people that are aware of it and that spend some time learning about it are generally supportive. And certainly when you go into the school systems, as I know you do and have, and I do, you find that young people are reasonably knowledgeable about space, not as knowledgeable about the history of space as we would like, but nevertheless knowledgeable and interested and excited about the potential opportunities in the future, in their future, for space exploration. And increasingly, I think, an understanding that there are resources out there, particularly on the moon, that can be extraordinarily valuable to us here on Earth.
In your book, you talk about helium-3, which is on the moon, and then, of course, it requires the development of fusion. Is it government's role to foster the development of this type of program, say, to develop a starter plant, a pilot plant project?
I think government could be very helpful in establishing an environment in which the private investors would feel more comfortable what would be considered by investors as risky investments in space, and they would have to get a return on investment commensurate with their perception of that risk. And I've tried to illustrate that in the book, that philosophy that investors have to have. And I'm being an investor, I understand that totally, and being in business, I understand it. But the government can establish an environment of credibility that is important to investors. Why, I don't know, because the government often doesn't follow through, it doesn't get things done, and doesn't do them efficiently. But many investors like to see the support and endorsement of government in major projects of this kind, whether they're here on Earth or are in space. And theoretically or hypothetically, it's not necessary that government be a player, but sometimes it's very helpful that they are. And I would like to see, as a private citizen, not in my capacity as chairman of the NASA Advisory Committee, but as a private citizen, I would like to see that the government begin to investigate and understand just what the opportunities are for the country and for humankind by tapping the energy resources of the moon.
We have a caller on hold, but first, you know, the government is indirectly sort of doing this, but they keep it as a deep, dark secret because they do fund billions of dollars for fusion research in the giant tokamak fusion reactors that they're trying to create, but they don't link that to anything that would lead to a commercial or a personal benefit for the citizens. From my perspective, whether the tokamak will ever work or not maybe is not the issue. If we understood the outcome and the application of what was going on, we might have a totally different attitude about how to go after developing these resources, Lunar HE3 and the space program. Am I off base here?
No, I don't think so at all, David. I think increasingly, because of the perception that fossil fuels are either becoming increasingly scarce or are no longer in the long term compatible with a productive environment here on Earth, that we're going to have to begin to look at energy systems that do not produce greenhouse gases, particularly carbon dioxide and methane, and that nuclear power, in very broadly categorized, is probably the most available and viable commercial option that we have today. Certainly nuclear fission, which is what some 20% of the energy in the United States, electrical energy in the United States, is produced by, is already in place and could be expanded fairly rapidly if the regulatory hurdles are removed, and not totally removed. You don't want them totally removed, but instead of taking 10 or 15 years to get a plant online, let's get them online in 5 years, which is certainly feasible. Do it safely with the new technologies that are available. That could be done. And so I'm not at all opposed to moving forward for a whole bunch of reasons with the standard fission power plants that we have today. And at the same time, we're going to have to build clean coal plants. So we need that energy. There's no alternative but for our growth and our national security, but to have secure supplies of electrical power. Now, the long term, and hopefully not too long, opportunity is in fusion power. That's instead of splitting atoms, as fission power does, you combine atoms, and you get energy from that combination. The government has for many decades focused its resources, the taxpayers' resources, on a form of fusion power that's called deuterium-tritium. Deuterium is, they're both deuterium and tritium are heavy isotopes of hydrogen, and the tritium is actually radioactive. It has a half-life, that is, half of it decays in about 13 years, and coincidentally, it decays to helium-3, and that's important to us, as we'll probably talk about later. But that fusion cycle, DT, has many, many disadvantages. Its primary disadvantage is that the reaction product that is produced when you fuse deuterium and tritium together is a neutron. And neutrons are uncontrollable. It's a small, heavy particle, uncontrollable. And when they interact with the walls of your of your fusion reactor, they, as they have to do in order to extract heat energy, they also create high-level radioactive waste. And they tend to, over a 3 or 4 year period in a operating power plant, if one could have one, would effectively destroy the structural integrity of the walls of the power plant. So you can see that there are some major disadvantages of that fusion cycle, even though it is the easiest to work on from a physics point of view. Helium-3 has none of those disadvantages. Helium-3 deuterium fusion can produce a few neutrons, but they're low-energy neutrons, and they do not affect the commercially viable operating life of a power plant. Helium-3 fusion, though, would produce no neutrons. It produces all of its energy in the form of a positively charged proton, another primary particle. And protons not only have entirely different properties when they interact with materials, but they can be controlled by electrostatic fields and therefore do not interact with the walls of the reactor. And you can go to a direct conversion cycle of those protons being positively charged to electricity. So there are many, many advantages to helium-3. The physics is a lot tougher, no question about that. But in the University of Wisconsin basement laboratories, they are continually demonstrating fusion power with helium-3 deuterium and are on the verge of demonstrating the helium-3 fusion reaction in a controlled, steady-state environment. We're very optimistic that given the investor funding necessary, that you can not only get viable commercial helium-3 power plants, but that you can also develop the resource base, which is primarily on the moon. You can ask, well, if helium-3 is so great, why in the world don't we do it now? Well, it's because there's not much helium-3 here on Earth. Most of the helium-3 available for research comes from the decay of tritium. Tritium that is used in nuclear weapons that has to be cleaned up every once in a while, and when you clean it up, you get a supply of helium-3 for research purposes, but not nearly enough for an actual commercial power plant system. So there's a lot that would have to come together for fusion to be available in the not too distant future, but it could happen. And then I try to lay out that path to commercialization in the book that you referred to.
I do want to continue talking with you about fusion and getting resources from the moon, but we've had a caller patiently on hold. Let's see what he or she wants to say. Caller, are you with us?
Yes, sir.
And you are, and you have a question for Dr. Schmidt.
I'm John Juris in Billings, Montana, and...
hey, great country up there. I love that country.
It's very nice, as is Madison.
I worked over around Butte one summer for the U.S. Geological Survey and had been in Billings many times. I have kinfolk, as a matter of fact, in Billings, the Haubine family.
Oh, Pete Haubine? Yes, I know him well.
Yep.
Well, John is being modest. He was also on faculty in the medical school at the University of Wisconsin, so.
Oh, great. Well, I'm not an alumni, but I'm adjunct, so I guess we have something in common.
A little something. The reason I called was the article last week in Science Magazine about the NAC was rather negative, which isn't too surprising given the venue in which it was published. But I thought in the interest of fairness, it would be nice to hear your take on the supposed split within the NAC.
Well, there's no split in the NAC. There certainly is in the scientific community some disagreement on among some in the scientific community, so-called, some disagreement in what the function of the NASA Advisory Council is. There's no question in the administrator's mind or in mine, Administrator Mike Griffin, that the function of the restructured NASA Advisory Council is to advise the administrator, and I think that sort of goes without saying. We cannot be advisors to the President or the Congress. The Congress and the President establish what national space policy is going to be. The administrator has the responsibility to implement that policy, and the NASA Advisory Council has been convened and structured by the administrator to provide him with the best advice that we can from extraordinarily competent and experienced people about how best to do that implementation. But the responsibility for implementation is his. It's not ours. And we cannot change congressional and presidential policy within the venue of the Advisory Council. There are other venues where people are absolutely free to express their opinions. But when you're working in the council, you've got to do things that are helpful to the administrator in the implementation of policy, whether you agree with it or not.
Thank you. I think that clarifies things quite a bit.
Well, I hope so. I have not yet had a chance to see the science article, so I don't know whether that responds to it or not. I did talk with them, but I don't know how they characterize my remarks.
Did they spin it toward his remarks, John, or did they do it differently?
Well, the take that I had from the article was the committee is heading away from advising specifically on science and is focusing excessively on the concept of getting back to the moon and Mars, which I would happen to personally favor anyway, rather
it
than
happens to be science.
And I'm not surprised because of the venue in which the article was published.
Well, there is a tendency in what is referred to broadly as the scientific community to not include in that community what I, as a geologist, and there are many geophysicists and geochemists and planetologists and others out there would call exploration science. That involves using humans, and there are many people who feel threatened, either financially or otherwise, by the president's emphasis on taking human beings back into deep space, as we were during the Apollo program. I happen to fully support that effort. I think that's where human beings belong. There's a great deal that robotic systems can do in support of human exploration and in addition to human exploration. But I think it's the role of humankind to move outward in to the frontiers of space and to learn directly what human beings can learn and robots cannot by interacting with the environment that you find there. But that is not the general view of many in the scientific community, as it is generally referred to. If you talk about exploration in deep space, the moon and Mars and beyond, as the president has, he is referring to having human beings as well as robots move outward and work in those new environments, test yourself and humankind and human systems against that environment. And I think it's the most exciting thing that human beings can do is to work at the frontier of human endeavor wherever it happens to be. And in the case of the vision for space exploration, that frontier is in space.
Makes sense to me.
And you win his book, John. Thank you for the call.
Hey,
thank
John,
you.
Take care of yourself. If you run into Holbein's, give him my best.
Will do. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Dr. Schmidt, this is a little bit off, but maybe you can help me resolve this in my own mind. I've been thinking about this a lot since I returned from the SmallSat conference in Utah a couple of weeks ago, and I had this conversation with quite a few people. The science budget is being cut and reduced at JPL, NASA, et cetera, and it does affect people's lives. There's no doubt about that. You've seen this from the view of a U.S. senator as also a scientist involved in cutting edge. How do you prioritize what kind of science project gets funded? Is it important to do deep space research, or is it important to put money into the National Institutes of Health and try to find a drug for heart attack or cancer? I mean, we live in an age where we don't have unlimited budgets. We've never had unlimited budgets, but that's really clear today in 2006. how do you prioritize to get the most bang for your research and scientific money?
Well, it's very difficult to get agreement on where one should focus, and for that reason, the country has traditionally had a very broad base of scientific research that covers many, many different fields, health, space, defense, and you name it. And I think that's really what you have to do, and try, and it's the president's job, really, to establish what he perceives to be the national needs at any given time, and it's Congress's job to evaluate the president's judgment on that and apply their own. And that has been traditionally what has happened. In the case of space science, however, I think there's a misperception. Space science over the last decade has grown significantly, the 5-7% rate of growth, annual growth. And the current budget does not cut the space budget. It reduces its rate of growth. And people have to understand that. Unfortunately, in today's politics, anytime you reduce the rate of growth of something, it is conjured up as a cut in that program. And I think that's just that's an incorrect characterization. Yes, space science budget, the budget for the Science Mission Directorate, rate of growth has been reduced. It has had significant impact. But the rate of growth of other parts of NASA's budget also has been reduced in order to take care of something that Administrator Griffin ran into and was unknown to him when he arrived on the scene, is that there had been major cost growth that had not been advertised in several programs. And not only the return to flight of the shuttle, but also the space station, which are national, by national policy, we are going to complete the International Space Station. People have to recognize that. And the only way that can be done is to continue to fly the space shuttle at least up to 2010. Now, given those kinds of national policy constraints, there have been reductions in the rate of growth of the president's exploration program, in the rate of growth of the science budget, and in other aspects of NASA. A great deal of belt tightening is going on, and Administrator Griffin is very, very good at understanding how to make that happen. But still, the realities are that the growth has been reduced. Now, there also have been problems within the science budget area by itself. The cost growth in the James Webb Telescope, for example, has just been extraordinary versus what was originally put forth by its advocates and both in and out of NASA. And that is eating into the budget of the Science Mission Directorate as much as anything else. The cost growth in recent years have been on the order of $1.5 billion. Well, that's a heck of a lot of research and analysis money and other things that could be used. And then that's something that, in fact, the NASA Advisory Council is going to have to look at, is what can be done to make sure that that telescope and other programs, James Webb Telescope and other science programs, live within the budgets that are identified at an early stage to support them.
Speaking on just exactly what you're talking about, there's a chat comment from Sharon in Roundup, Montana, who wants to know what you might have done differently if you could do it over, specifically what you would be doing differently if you were the NASA boss.
Well, right now, I think Administrator Griffin and I are entirely on the same page. We have been conversant on these issues for many years. I think we understand pretty well what the realities are. And I don't know how I would I could do much differently than he's already doing. If you want to go way back in history, I think the first major error that NASA made was actually in 1969, NASA and the Congress and the country made before Neil Armstrong ever stepped on the moon, and that was to terminate the production line of Saturn V launch vehicles. That began a process of retrenchment in the use of the Apollo technology base and in its final amortization that we are paying for today. There was nothing in that couldn't have been done that we have wanted to do in space that could not have been done using the Saturn Apollo technology foundation. And NASA of that time decided that it wanted to propose a whole new space vehicle, the name what ultimately became the space shuttle, but actually the original proposal at that time was to go forward with a space station, access to which was going to be provided by the shuttle. And I think that was a major historical error in policy advocacy by NASA, and that we should have continued to build on that technology base that had been so successful for us during Apollo. If we had done that, there are many indirect consequences that are high in the minds of many people who follow space these days. One of them is that if we continue, if we had a Saturn V capability, that's the launch vehicle for the Apollo moon missions, we would have routinely the capability of diverting asteroids that might be on an impact or near impact trajectory towards the Earth. We had that during the Apollo era. People probably don't realize that, but we could have protected the Earth with the technology that we had during Apollo. And I bring this out in my book in a limited way, is that there are many other things that having heavy lift launch capability of the scale of Apollo, that is something on the order of 50 to 100 metric tons on a trajectory to the moon and all and beyond, gives us many additional benefits that we do not have today, and indeed won't have for a very long time.
We have another caller on hold, and then I want to get back to talking to you about fusion and how we access the moon, which is related to your book and your Saturn V, Saturn VI program. But, caller, are you still with us?
Dave?
Yes.
This is Rick Sterling.
Rick, do you have a comment or question for Dr. Schmidt?
Dr. Schmidt, it's good to talk to you.
Great. Rick, where are you from?
I'm from Wheeling, West Virginia.
Wheeling!
You know Wheeling?
I have some very fine glassware from Wheeling, West Virginia.
Fostoria?
Up in one of my travels. It's beautiful stuff.
Oh, that's nice. It's always nice to talk to you. Dr. Schmidt, I want to commend you for your excellent support of President Bush's vision for space exploration. I read an article a few days ago that, in a derogatory sense, said that you were, quote, gung-ho about President Bush's VSE. But in my opinion, that was a complimentary situation, because we need somebody to be an advocate for President Bush's vision for space exploration. I have a question. I'm very interested in lunar transient phenomena, and I know during your mission you cited an example of lunar transient phenomena near Grimaldi Crater.
Yes.
Let me read you air-to-ground transcript of your comments, and I want you to comment. This is Apollo 17 ground-to-air, December 29, 1972. It says, and this is you talking, lunar module pilot, was there any indication on the seismometers on the impact about the time I saw the light flash on the surface? Capcom said, stand by, we'll check on that, Jack. Then you say, a UFO perhaps, don't know about it. I thought somebody was looking at it. It could have been on one of the other flashes of light. My question is, why did you call the flash a UFO, and what is your best opinion at this point as to what could be causing these flashes of light?
Well, I don't read that again. I call it a UFO.
That's what's in the transcript. Now, unless the transcript is wrong, and that's always a possibility.
Yeah, those transcripts are sometimes a little strange. The Apollo Lunar Surface Science Journal, which Eric Jones is the webmaster for, is an example of where I was able to help him get all the astronauts, most of the astronauts, to review the transcripts and get them edited so that they are correct.
Well, this may be an incorrect transmission. Well,
I don't know about that, but I tell you, right from the beginning, I thought that that flash was a meteor hitting the surface. And the meteors would give off, and more recently, in some of these meteor shower periods, people have been observing the moon much more closely than in the past, and they've been able to pick up some of these transient light flashes. So I'm pretty sure that what I saw was a meteor.
Okay, if I recall, I'm sure you know Dr. Frukiel Boss.
Yes.
His opinion is that they conducted several tests, and this was mentioned several times on the television, I believe on a Learning Channel program he mentioned this, where they went back and checked the seismometers where there was these lunar transit phenomena light flashes, and they didn't detect any impact on the seismometers. If we assume, hypothetically, for the sake of the argument, that they aren't meteoroid impacts or meteorite impacts, what else could they be?
Well, that's why I think it's a meteor. There's not much choice, and it doesn't take a very large meteor, one that might not have recorded on the seismometers, and you would have much more precise timing than my verbal statement would have given to really be sure, unless it was a very large one. We haven't had seismometers operating on the moon during this period of time more recently when observers on Earth are seeing these meteor impacts during the Leonid meteor shower and the like. I just don't think we have the data right now. Maybe when we can get a net of seismometers, which I think is a very, very important scientific goal, is a net of seismometers on the moon. And Clive Neal at Notre Dame is very actively pursuing how this might be done. I think once we have that we'll be able to see these correlations during meteor showers.
Well, you know, the Russians are working on this Lunar Glob mission. It's going to put a network of seismometers near the South Pole. Would that fit into this whole scenario of detecting impact?
Global network, yes.
Okay. Well, very much appreciate talking to you, Dr. Schmidt, and good luck with your work on the NASA Advisory Committee, and thank God we have somebody like you that's willing to take a public stance courageously in support of President Bush's program.
Well, it certainly makes a lot of sense to me, and I think it makes a lot of sense to the young people of the future, as a matter of fact.
Thank you, Rick, and you win the second copy of the book. And Dr. Schmidt, we're behind on our break, so we're going to take a short 2-minute pause. Everybody stay right where you are, and we will be back with our guest today, Dr. Harrison Schmidt, in 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners and sponsors for their support. Having a spacefaring society and culture is not only important, it's crucial for humanity. It is also a large undertaking for everyone involved in this mission, and The Space Show is no exception. So join with us by visiting www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Please make a contribution which will help us in continuing to bring you our programming and services, all free of charge. The Space Show also has available opportunities for advertising and sponsorship on air, the archived programs, the newsletter, and the website. For information, contact Dr. Livingston at drspace@thespaceshow.com or 415-435-6018. Again, The Space Show thanks you for listening and for your support.
Stand by to enter the Space Show.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, host of The Space Show. Join with my guest and me as we explore real possibilities for working, living, and yes, even playing in space. Visit www.thespaceshow.com. For more information, contact Dr. Space at thespaceshow.com.
Stand by to hear the latest about real space business and development opportunities.
Four forward, drift into the right level. Take
The mission of the space show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The space show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Space Show. This is your host, David Livingston, our guest today, Dr. Harrison Schmidt. And Dr. Schmidt, in order to see the moon as a source of energy for us, as well as other commercial benefit uses, we need two things. We obviously need to get the fusion going, and we need to be able to get back to the moon. So let's start with fusion. And realistically, where do we stand now with our efforts to create fusion, either with the ITER agreement plant that's being built, tokamaks, the alternative programs that I've heard about? What can you tell us about the reality of fusion?
Well, reality is in the eyes of the beholder, I guess, but the reality that I see is that the DT tokamak, what is often referred to fuel cycle technology, is of very great interest from a physics point of view, because you can do it. You can probably more easily get to a break even, that is a little more energy coming out than going in, with a DT cycle, if you really focus a lot of resources on it. Now, and I mean a lot of resources, the current estimates, I think, for the ITER, the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, I think is what the acronym means, which is going to be located in France now. Those estimates have gone from about $5 billion now, and I think they're approaching $15 billion to get that project done. The U.S. has about a 10% interest in it. It's mostly a European and Japanese project now. And it is going to, as I understand it, it is basically an experiment. It is not the development of a commercial fusion reactor, and it's not even clear to everybody involved that you can get to break even with this particular experiment. It is being designed to do that, and you'll just have to wait and see. The big problem, I think, is that all through the development of this deuterium-tritium fusion for the last several decades, it's been mainly run by the physics community as experiments, rather than involving in a major way the engineering community with an eye towards actually building commercial reactors. Now, there is a problem with that, and that is that it's not clear that you could ever have a commercial tokamak DT reactor. As I talked about a bit earlier, the fact that your primary source of energy is through neutrons that destroy the structural integrity of your reactor, and therefore you have to replace the first wall on a regular basis, like every 3 or 4 years. And those first walls that you take out are full of high-level radioactive waste, and that has to be disposed of. There's a great deal of radioactive waste that will come from these systems. All of that sort of makes it mitigates against there it being ever being a commercial system. As I said earlier, the nice thing about a helium-3-based system is that either all or most of your reaction products are protons, and they can be controlled by electrostatic forces, and therefore you do not have this radioactive waste problem or the structural integrity problem that comes with DT. And also the basic capital cost of a electrostatic device is much, much less than the tokamak, which depends on these huge, high-strength magnets, which are very, very expensive, and raise the capital cost of a DT system, a deuterium-tritium system, to levels that are probably beyond what can be supported by a commercial power industry.
So in a really good world with capital and a positive regulatory environment, and with science and engineering making above-average progress, when could we see a commercial fusion reactor?
Well, first of all, I think that with a steady flow of capital and at a a level that can be sustained by research, and that will sustain research, that you could have a commercial deuterium helium-3 fusion reactor within about a demonstration within about 10 years. It is simpler to do. It's not easy, but it's simpler than the tokamak system. And that's probably involves an investment of about $5 billion. Now, that sounds like a lot, but it's only about a third of what the original Alaska pipeline cost in now year dollars. So it's well within the ballpark of what the commercial sector is used to doing and investing for these kinds of very high payoff future projects. Another thing to remember is that because the dehelium-3 does not deal with any radioactive products, and it's not, they're not radioactive in themselves, the regulatory environment is much more benign than it would be for a DT system.
Well, Terry from Texas has sent in this comment, which is probably appropriate right now. Fusion is the answer. The question is, why the hell don't we have it? They promised it to us with hover cars back in the 1950s. So is this because of the science community, the lack of funding, the difficulty, the challenges, or all of the above?
Probably all of the above, David. Once we realized the difficulty of the dehelium-3 cycle, the deuterium-tritium cycle, we probably should have been rational enough to say, look, this just isn't going to do it for commercial fusion. It's a great thing to do for plasma research, but let's concentrate now on something that would an alternative fuel, if you will, that would actually get us to a commercial fusion reactor. And that's not been done yet. It hasn't been done in this country. It hasn't been done anywhere else, although you hear more conversation in government circles, at least, in Japan and China and Russia about helium-3 than you'll ever hear in government circles in Washington.
Well, we go down an independent path to do the helium-3, but we also right now in 2006 cannot get back to the moon. The heavy lift vehicle that they're proposing, which would be made from shuttle-derived parts, is not going to be as large as the Saturn V was. In your book, you talk about a new Saturn VI, which streamlined manufacturing and project management characteristics to lower the cost of its development. What do you think the best way is for us to get back to the moon?
Well, I think the realities that Administrator Griffin faces today dictate that he work with as much of existing rocket technology as he can in order to carry out the president's vision. The federal budget is just not right now. NASA's federal budget is not going to support going back and recreating the Apollo Saturn V technology. That just isn't going to happen. I think the private sector could do that if one can finally get them to realize the tremendous economic potential and financial potential of a helium-3 fusion power system. But we haven't been able to convince the major investors yet that we need that can can happen. The nice thing, one of the nice things about the helium-3, and one thing that makes it attractive to the private sector, I would think, and I point this out in the book, is that there are a number of steps in the technology development that have commercial potential in and of themselves. In fact, at the level of steady-state fusion, helium-3 deuterium fusion, that is underway at Wisconsin basically as we speak in the research lab, you can clearly design a commercially viable isotope production system that would support positron emission tomography. As your listeners, I'm sure, are aware, positron emission tomography is based on the use of positron-emitting isotopes, today mostly an isotope of fluorine-18, that has a half-life of about 110 minutes. And these are attached to a glucose molecule put into your body, and they are attracted to where glucose is being consumed very rapidly, and that is in tumors. And so you get a very high-resolution picture of cancerous tumors in the human body using what is called PET, positron emission tomography diagnostics, in major urban centers today. The problem is that PET is not available in rural and in small urban centers because of the cost of producing these fluorine 18 molecules. The helium-3 deuterium technology can be used to produce these at point of use at much, much lower cost than currently can be done using cyclotrons. Since they're very short half-life isotopes, you have to have them pretty close to where you're going to use them, or they're gone by the time you get them there. Now, there's another major advantage to using helium-3 deuterium isotope production system at point of use is that you're not confined to using the relatively long half-life fluorine 18. You can go to very short half-life isotopes such as nitrogen 13, I believe it is, that has a 10-minute half-life. And if you can do that, then pregnant women and children can begin to take advantage of the use of PET diagnostic systems. Today, because of the residual radioactive dose that is left with a 110-minute half-life of fluorine 18, pregnant women and children cannot benefit from these kinds of diagnostic techniques. With a nitrogen 13 isotope and a 10-minute half-life, they could. And in fact, there are two other isotopes. There's a carbon 11 and an oxygen 15, I believe it is, that have even shorter half-lives, and they could even offer greater advantages. But to do that, you have to have your isotope production at point of use. And that's the cyclotron just can't do that. It's much too expensive, much too big. They're $2.5 million a piece, something like that. Helium-3 deuterium system would at point of use, could satisfy that kind of market. So, and that's just the first of a number of business opportunities that exist as you develop the technologies for helium-3 fusion power.
Are you at all familiar with an alternative program called Focus Fusion, where the fuel is hydrogen boron?
Oh, yeah, P boron 11. Yeah, I am. And one of the big advantages of that is that there's plenty of boron here on Earth that you can use for that reaction. There are, though, technically some significant issues in P boron 11, which I would not be fully competent to get into detail on. I mention a few of them, I think, in my book. We have been looking at that, keeping our eye on it. Right now, it doesn't look like it would compete commercially with the deuterium helium 3. But again, you know, you let all flowers bloom, and the marketplace will be the final determinant.
Yeah, I think Eric Lerner is behind that. He's been a guest on the show several times, and he's looking for an out of the box solution for confining plasma for the fusion. So that's the approach that he's taking, and he is also looking for funding, obviously. Seems to be the age-old story for making things go forward, right? We need funding.
Oh yeah, and you got to present a good business plan, one that people believe can be implemented.
If I can read a little short passage from your introduction, I want to ask you about this. President Bush's policy-driven initiative requires a sustained commitment of funding, as well as tough, competent, and disciplined management comparable to the Apollo program of the 1960s and early 70s. If the government of the United States wishes to lead the return of humans to deep space, its space agency of today is probably not yet the agency to undertake this new program. NASA lacks the critical mass of youthful energy and imagination required for work in deep space. NASA also has become too bureaucratic and too risk-averse to efficiently address the president's challenge. To be assured of success, NASA would need to be totally restructured. Although some steps in this direction are occurring, the task faced by NASA remains formidable. So I'm assuming you're still stand behind that paragraph, right?
Well, I do for the time in which it was written, but you got to realize that that since that was written, and in fact, in the process, in the editing process, the new administrator was put into place, Mike Griffin, and I was just barely had time to insert that in a few places in the book. Griffin has taken it upon himself to basically do what I have suggested needed to be done, and it's a long, tedious process. And I don't think anybody would say it's complete, but it's a process in which the NASA Advisory Council is participating vigorously. For example, and in particular in the financial management side of things, of trying to get NASA on a track where they can get a clean, independent audit, and the centers now are all on the same auditing, same financial reporting system. These kind of things are finally happening. Should have happened a long time ago, and you have to give Administrator Griffin all the credit in the world for beginning to and very rapidly restructuring the agency so it can carry out not only the president's vision but other programs that the Congress expects NASA to undertake.
There was a lot of talk, especially in the space advocacy community, that when the search was going on for a new NASA administrator, that you were a high-ranking choice. Would you have wanted that position?
Oh, I have said for many years that up until the current time, I would have been happy to have taken on that challenge, but I was not asked to do it, and therefore I'm not doing it. I think they have made probably what would be a far better choice in Mike Griffin. Now, he is exactly the kind of person that I think NASA, an organization like NASA, needs. Very bright, very knowledgeable technically, a very broad-based engineer, knows how to ask the right questions. That is absolutely essential for the administrator of NASA. And unfortunately, we went through several administrators in modern times that did not have the kind of solid engineering background necessary, and really couldn't ask the right questions, and we paid some price for that.
Well, he is definitely shaking the status quo, because I hear the comments all the time on the show from people who are impacted one way or another.
That's right.
And you don't get a neutral vote with Dr. Griffin. You either love him or you hate him. To the degree that anyone would be the NASA administrator, yourself, Dr. Griffin, anybody, how much of their own person can they be versus they're there to follow the specific mandate of the president who hired them and Congress who funds them? Can they be an independent person?
Well, you're independent. You work for the president. and the Congress. And you're independent in that, initially, in that the each year you put together a budget and you put together a five-year projection of that budget, and implicit in the proposal that the NASA administrator finally gives to the Office of Management and Budget are recommendations for national policy. And the president, and through the OMB, can either say, yes, we're going to do that, or no, we're not going to do that, as far as the president's concerned. And then the budget is sent to the Congress containing what is finally determined to be NASA's proposed budget. Then the Congress works their wonder on it. But at that point, the administrator is constrained, and should be, to supporting the budget that the president has proposed to the Congress. Now, that doesn't mean he can't and shouldn't answer questions posed by congressmen and senators relative to other alternatives. He's obligated to speak frankly and directly and factually in answer to any questions that are posed. And so in that context, the Congress gets information that may indeed alter their view of the president's budget, either in support or by adding other things to it. Now, one of the major things that the administrator has not been able to in recent years to effect, and that is this earmarking. I don't know what the final number was for 07, but it's in the range, I think, of $500 million of congressional pork barrel earmarks. And that's a big chunk of money. For example, about half of NASA's overall education funding is earmarked. Well, that takes away a lot of the management flexibility in actually implementing a coherent program. And it's something Congress really has to get to grips with. When I was there back in the early 80s, late 70s, this problem was just starting to raise its ugly head, and it is just grown like Topsy. It's just unbelievably bad policy for the Congress to be earmarking and fencing in the management flexibility for the administrator. I wish there was some way that we could get to that, and of course a line item veto in the hands of the president would be an excellent process where I doubt if Congress will ever give him that power, though.
I doubt so, too, but let's pause right there. We have our next break, and we will be back with Dr. Schmidt in 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners and sponsors for their support. Having a spacefaring society and culture is not only important, it's crucial for humanity. It is also a large undertaking for everyone involved in this mission, and the Space Show is no exception. So join with us by visiting www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Please make a contribution which will help us in continuing to bring you our programming and services, all free of charge. The Space Show also has available opportunities for advertising and sponsorship on air, the archived programs, the newsletter, and the website. For information, contact Dr. Livingston at drspace@thespaceshow.com or 415-435-6018. Again, The Space Show thanks you for listening and for your support.
Stand by to enter the Space Show.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, host of The Space Show. Join with my guest and me as we explore real possibilities for working, living, and yes, even playing in space. Visit www.thespaceshow.com. For more information, contact Dr. Space at thespaceshow.com.
Stand by to hear the latest about real space business and development opportunities.
Four forward, drifting to the right level. 6.5. 30 seconds, over. Right. Contact right. Okay, engine stop. Drifting, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back to the Space Show. This is your host, David Livingston. Our guest today, Dr. Harrison Schmidt. And Harrison, I know we have some things we want to get into, but I have a caller on hold and a quick set of questions from Terry in Texas. And Terry wanted to know if you would be willing to go back to the moon, and if so, would you rather ride on a New Vision vehicle or the Saturn V?
Well, I'd love to go back to the moon, and my wife, Teresa, has indicated she'd like to go with me, too. I think that'd be great, but and I think that as long as you have good design and program and financial management, I would be willing to ride on any launch vehicle that NASA would put together or that a private industry group would put together.
Okay, and we have a caller with us. Caller, are you still with us?
Yes, sir.
And you are?
Marshall.
Marshall, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you. As usual, I have a few questions, so let's start out with what I think is the most interesting one. I've read your book, and I noticed a reference number 90 on page 93, you make a reference to Eastern Stoker Coal and then use the $2.50 per million BTUs as a basis for your economic arguments for mining helium-3 on the moon. My problem is Eastern Stoker Coal is not a standardized commodity that you can look up on the Internet. Why did you choose Eastern Stoker Coal over a standardized product like Brent crude oil or ethanol or spot market electricity?
Well, first of all, the coal is the primary competitor and for any power system in the future. We're going to keep using coal for the foreseeable future, and I think it's going to stay very close to 50% of our total power, electrical power production. And so you've got to look at it as your competitor. It's also the cheapest fuel that is available for electrical power production, even though its price has been climbing. If you want to look at the coal prices, one of the good places to look is at the Department of Energy website. I don't remember the. I think I have it in the book a few places. And they use that terminology as well. You can use almost any form of steam coal. Sometimes that's also used, and it has on a spot basis. Those coal prices have been well over $3 now since that book was written. It has continued to rise, but I stuck with the $2.50 just to give sort of a minimum financial envelope into which a fusion power system or any power system would have to fit in order to be commercially viable. And to produce electricity at the bus bar, that would be competitive. I think you'll notice in there in one place at the time the book was written, the sort of the general bus bar price was 5 cents a kilowatt hour. And so I said we have to meet a 4 cents per kilowatt hour to get into the marketplace. So I tried to build those kinds of constraints into it. I'm not claiming that I did it perfectly, but certainly my intent was to make sure that we understood at this stage of the game just what financial targets and objectives helium-3 fusion would have to meet in order to actually become a commercially viable system. Without any government subsidies or anything like that.
Yeah. I think you made your case quite well. It's just that I would have used something that was a little more expensive power to promote myself a little better, something like crude oil.
Well, I'm a guy, when you look at crude oil, unfortunately, crude oil is not used for power production very much. But you look at that, we are extraordinarily competitive.
But absolutely.
But it's apples and oranges. You really have to look at what is going to be producing electrical power. And we certainly are competitive relative to nuclear. The cheapest is coal, and that seemed to. I'm an old conservative, and I just say, all right, if you're going, you got to be realistic with yourself. You got to be realistic with your investors, potential investors, and so you take the hardest case to meet and see if you can meet it.
Okay. How about we move to chapter 13, section 6. You imply that you envision families with children born on the moon base. Why did you choose the moon base over a space station?
Well, one is I need them there. I need settlers. It's the cheapest way, the most cost-effective way to operate a resource enterprise is to have people living at the mine mouth, as sometimes the term is used. It's a classic way in which resources were developed here on Earth, is you build a company town and people live there for long periods of time. And with respect to the moon, is even more important because it is costly to bring people back. So you want settlers, and if you have settlers, you have to sort of assume that some of those settlers are going to have children. That's what happens.
And so
you've got to prepare and try to understand the human cultural as well as the physiological implications of children growing up in a 1/6 gravity environment.
Thank you very much. I understand there's probably plenty of other people with questions, so thank you for talking to me.
Thank you, Marshall, and call back later if you have time and you have more questions.
Okay, bye.
Okay, thank you. And for listeners, I don't have a rule where you can only call the show once, so you can call in as often as you can get into the line as long as you have something to contribute. We welcome your participation. Harrison, I have this question from Dr. Bill Rowe. There has been concern in the past several years regarding inhalation of urban particulate matter with the potential of significant cardiovascular complications such as hypertension. Do you consider inhalation of ultrafine particles in the lunar module a significant risk? Might there be a significant difference in particle size from one lunar site in comparison to another?
Well, with respect to the last part of Dr. Rowe's question, and we've been in correspondence for many years about this and other issues, the particle size has been pretty well determined throughout the moon by the micrometeoroid environment that every part of the moon is exposed to. And so I don't expect there to be major differences on the average in particle size distribution from site to site. Now, from place to place in a site, fresh crater rim to old crater rim, yeah, there would be a significant difference. But on the average, you'll be exposed to the same particle size for frequency distribution that from one place to another. Now, I think that it is extremely important that that lunar settlers and lunar workers not be exposed for long periods of time to the ultrafine particles of lunar dust. We have experience here on Earth with mineral dust causing significant health problems and through chronic exposure, and I think that has to be avoided. And that's why what I argue for from an engineering point of view is a layered defense so that you're never exposed to it, that you have various ways in which you reduce the and essentially eliminate the ultrafine particles. We have to realize that as human beings, we've evolved over a very long period of time, millions and millions of years, a lung system that is pretty well protected against fine particles, because at least down to the size that nature generates. Evolution has made sure that we're fairly well protected
from those kinds of particles. It is in the ultrafine, particularly the micron, submicron size particles, that we're not protected because nature really doesn't produce those very often. And it is only human activity that has started to produce them here on Earth and has caused difficulties. And on the moon, it is natural activity of micrometeoroid bombardment that produces these extremely fine particles. Now, for the limited exposure the Apollo astronauts had, in my case, four different times did we get exposed to breathing some of that dust, that appears to not have had any noticeable effect. The dose was, overall dose was very small. But if you're going to be there for indefinite periods of time, you're going to have much, have some protection other than what we had, which was practically nothing other than the limitation on the number of times we were exposed. You're just going to want to make sure that the dust does not enter your habitats, that it's not in your suits. And there are certainly engineering solutions already known to making that happen. Let me just give you two examples. One is that the spacesuits, the pressure suits that one would use outdoors, might always be kept outdoors. You could design a suit so that you get in and out of it through a port with a suit always outside the space, outside your habitat. That's an Ames Research Center there in California has had this concept for some time. I think it's well worth something, something that we should be looking at for our long-term stays on the moon. Another thing is that we are fortunate in that this same process of micrometeoroid bombardment that creates the ultrafine particles also produces metallic iron particles, nano-sized particles, that coat, along with glass, almost essentially every particle of the dust, down to the finest sizes. And that means they're all magnetic. So as Dr. Larry Taylor, the University of Tennessee, has pointed out to all of us, you know, it's one of those things where you hit your forehead with the palm of your hand. Say, why didn't I think of that? But he has made it very clear, and that we can use the magnetic properties of these particles as a major defense against them being that dust accumulating anywhere in a habitat.
Is the dust really bad for the equipment?
Well, yes. You also, of course, I was talking primarily by human, but the same layered defense, I think, has to be applied to all your equipment. And it was applied to the lunar rovers, for example. We had hermetically sealed bearings. And as far as we know, none of those seals broke. We'd had no dust problems with the rover that we could detect. And so it is, from an engineering point of view, possible to protect moving parts. Now, we did not do nearly as well, in fact, we didn't do well at all, in keeping dust off of radiative surfaces, thermal radiation surfaces for cooling surfaces, or solar cells, or things like that. But there is also an engineering solution there. Because these particles are formed in a vacuum, each one of them has a negative charge. They're unsatisfied electron bonds on the particles, and so they're susceptible to electrostatic repulsion. So if you put a very slight positive charge on your equipment, the dust is not going to accumulate there. So we do have some very clear engineering solutions to provide this layered defense that I talked about, and I think they will be sufficient to offer more than adequate protection to human beings as well as equipment once we're operating continuously on the moon.
Dr. Schmidt, I want to return to the conversation you and I had during the break when I mentioned that there's a lot of unhappiness, to say the least, among many of my science friends at JPL and NASA and elsewhere with the direction that science funding has gone, the cutbacks, the careers that are being hurt and damaged. And you said you wanted to talk about that. You have an optional plan to say what perhaps Dr. Griffin is doing or others are doing.
Well, I must say that, you know, Dr. Griffin and and NASA generally trying to do everything they can to sustain the Bay research base of NASA and its affiliated research community, academic and otherwise. During the transition from the current situation where the shuttle is taking a great deal of the resource base of the agency to operate, to a time post-2010 when that funding wedge presumably opens up, and it'll be a much potentially much better environment. I think particularly hard hit have been the NASA centers that have been dependent on a steadily and quite rapidly growing science budget, as we talked about before, 5-7% a year, and now it is leveling off. At least it's not growing at that particular rate, and that makes it very tough. And the agency is going to have to figure out ways to get through that, and one of the ways in which that is happening is by trying to rationalize the distribution of personnel in the agency to where the needs are, the job. The agency budget is constant, and it's still been constant, growing slightly around $16 billion a year. But it's the other programs that are taking up the dollars besides the science budget. Now, one thing in the outside community, the research community, academic and otherwise, that I hope various academic administrations will begin to think about, and I've already asked some and some are, and that is, how do we provide over the next, say, 4 years or so, a bridge of funding to maintain our institutional capability within a given institution, research institution, to support faculty and students? Are there sources of funding outside of NASA, particularly from the private sector, that would help us sustain the research base necessary then to pick up the ball when NASA funding starts to reappear in the 2011-2012 timeframe? I think we in the outside private research institutions, and I am one of them, really owe it to ourselves to try to think out of the box on how bridge funding can be provided if we really believe that this is important science to be done. Now, I realize there's a lot of competition for science funds these days. There's a lot of things that universities are trying to do, stem cell research, nanotechnology, and the like. But those institutions that feel as if they're being hurt by the reduction in the rate of growth of the NASA science budget, if they really believe in it, they need to start thinking about how else could this be funded. We have major contributors, for example, that would provide sustaining funding while NASA begins to rationalize its own commitments, namely the national policies that require the continued flying of the space shuttle and the finished construction of the space station.
Do you your thinking is that scientists could be reallocated to work on projects that are more supportive or more directly contributing to the mission at hand, which is the manned return to the moon and onward?
Well, within the NASA structure, yes. Within the academic world and the other research institutions, most of that effort is in science. And what I'm suggesting there is that administrations, university administrations, for example, begin to think out of the box and say, can we find a mechanism for bridge financing until NASA is able to get back into the game and support the kind of projects that we believe in?
Now, is NASA and JPL used synonymously with you, or is there a big difference?
Well, JPL is the NASA center. It is unusual in that it is a contractor-operated, namely Caltech. but it functions as a NASA center.
Okay. One of the things that I was really impressed with in your book, and again, listeners, that the title is Return to the Moon, I'm assuming you can buy this book anywhere. The foreword is by Neil Armstrong. You can get it on Amazon or your local bookstore.
You better call your local bookstores. They can probably order it for you. I'm not sure you'll find it on the shelf.
They can order it. But
we're going into our second printing, and maybe that'll change their mind.
I'm very impressed with the amount of energy you have put into showing the project management that would be necessary to undertake the programs you're talking about in your book. And there's really an absence of focus on project management in space projects across the board from what I see in the people I've interviewed on this show. So if we can, for a few minutes, let's focus on project management. This appears to be the ability to either make or break the whole project, irregardless of the funding or even the team that you have assembled to do it. If you can't put the management together and manage all the various components and aspects of it, you're sort of dead in the water.
Well, unfortunately, the path to into space is overall has been successful, but is littered with the bones of projects that have been badly managed, whatever the merits of the project might have been. And if you look back, as I try to in the book, at what seemed to make a successful, produce a successful management system for Apollo, I think it gradually becomes very clear that there are some basic elements that management system has to have in order to successfully implement. People have to realize that there really were three major efforts to put human beings on the moon in the 1960s. One was by the then Soviet Union, which failed. The first United States effort can be said to have failed with the fire at the Kennedy Space Center that killed Gus Grissom and his crew. And it was the third, then, the second U.S. effort that was ultimately successful. And so that's what you look at, is what did it take finally to be able to operate in deep space. It's a very unforgiving environment in which to work. And you have to have a tough, competent, disciplined management system and managers in place to be there successfully and continuously. I think Apollo demonstrated the kind of system you need to have. Obviously, you will look at every situation and every time again, but there are just some fundamentals that I don't think change. And that's what I've tried to point out in the section on management.
And your book is probably one of the only ones, if not the only one, that goes into great detail, including planning out the management operation for a lunar HE3 program and fusion program, as well as an access program using a newly built Saturn VI, which you refer to. This is really a terrific bunch of information, and this alone tells me that everyone out there should be reading your book.
Well, I hope it will be helpful to people that are trying to do these kinds of things. And you know, those management lessons are good lessons for any kind of project, whether it's a space project or not.
We did a program the other night with Dr. Brad Edwards, and he addressed energy from space, and he was primarily talking about space solar power.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that Brad stressed was the kind of project management that would be needed to do a space solar power project from the beginning here on Earth to actually getting it into orbit or however you were going to do it, and then to operate and maintain it and keep it repaired.
Exactly.
And he is a project management guy from Los Alamos, and he just said we have nothing capable or even close to that right now today. Do you think we could muster that kind of management team right now?
Oh, I don't have any question that you could. You'd build it up gradually, but there certainly are people who have the right managerial talents and could be brought into a commercial program. Again, salaries and compensation and benefits would always be an issue. but still not as much an issue, I think, as in some other businesses, because there are an awful lot of people out there, very highly qualified people, who want to work on space projects. And you take advantage of that a little bit in the level of, you add it, you put that as part of the compensation. You're getting to work on space. And I think that's good. I think some of these, you know, startup rocket companies, SpaceX and SpaceDev and everything, are benefiting from gathering a lot of very good engineers together, because it's a space project, for crying out loud. I want to build rockets. And I can certainly sympathize with that. None of us involved in Apollo were there because of the salaries, believe me.
Speaking of the... the guys in the space launch business trying to do something different. I have a question from John, and he says, what do you see as a realistic and probably the most productive role for the alternative space movement?
The most important role, if he's talking about these the companies that are building launch vehicles, such as those that have now successfully won contracts in the so-called COTS program.
Right, and I think he probably means the advocate community as well, too, like the organizational world.
The thing you got to do is get your arms around how to be successful. Not many startup rocket companies have been successful. The fact is, there's only one. That's Orbital Sciences, and I happen to be biased a little bit because I'm a director. But if you look at the history, they have they're the only one so far that has taken private capital as a seed capital and successfully begun to build rockets and to make a functioning, ongoing company. Now, that doesn't mean it can't be done again, and I wish all of these other companies well, because I think it's very important to have a viable, competitive space launch industry out there, and NASA hopes, as I do, that the COTS program with SpaceX and Kistler, Rocket Plane Kistler, being the winners on that, will be able to successfully build, implement, and then provide a strong commercial economic base for systems that can supply the space station. You're going to have something after the shuttle is retired in order to do that. Now, NASA will stay there with the crew launch vehicles, or the launch vehicles that they're building, shuttle drive, as a backup, but they would like nothing better than to be able to turn over space station resupply and crew supply and return to the private sector. And that's the purpose of this whole COTS program, and those two awards were just announced, I think, last week. The most important thing SpaceX and Rocket Plane Kistler can do is to do it successfully, get good, quality, competent management, and make sure that what they're doing is going to work. And learn the lessons of the past and how you provide quality control and good design, and there are just some fundamentals here that don't change, and you have to do it by the book and do it by the fundamentals.
We're going to take our next and final break. Everybody stay where you are, and we will be back with Dr. Schmidt in 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners and sponsors for their support. Having a spacefaring society and culture is not only important, it's crucial for humanity. It is also a large undertaking for everyone involved in this mission, and the Space Show is no exception. So join with us by visiting www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Please make a contribution which will help us in continuing to bring you our programming and services, all free of charge. The Space Show also has available opportunities for advertising and sponsorship on air, the archived programs, the newsletter, and the website. For information, contact Dr. Livingston at drspace@thespaceshow.com or 415-435-6018. Again, The Space Show thanks you for listening and for your support.
Stand by to hear the latest about real space business and development opportunities.
I'm going to step off the land now. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Please stand by for The Space Show with Dr. David Livingston.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, host of The Space Show. Join with my guest and me as we explore real possibilities for working, living, and yes, even playing in space. Visit www.thespaceshow.com. For more information, contact Dr. Space at thespaceshow.com. Welcome back. This is The Space Show, and I'm your host, David Livingston. Our guest today, Dr. Harrison Schmidt. And I have a couple of questions about other forms of possible energy, Harrison, but you just commented on something that I think needs airing, and that goes back to the science programming, the media, the press. There seems to be a missing of what the benefits might be in a successful let's return to the moon, go on to Mars program. I mean, I have written peer-reviewed papers on the benefits that flowed into our economy from Apollo. And by the way, they still flow. They can still show up. People are still going into the space world, getting an education, starting businesses because of how they were inspired by what the Apollo astronauts and the Apollo program did. It's amazing the contribution to the wealth of a nation and individuals' wealth that a successful program can do. There's nothing else like it for a federal program. Why is this not focused on with President Bush's vision?
Well, I think there are a lot of things. There in the political realm, there is a great deal of unwillingness to give the president credit for anything, much less an initiative that looks this far into the future. And in the science community, there is a tendency, and has been, you know, all the way back into the beginnings, a strong tendency within some to not think that human spaceflight contributes as much potential to science as does robotic spaceflight. And even though they would never, as experimental scientists, would never conceive of having robots doing their laboratory work for them. Now, in some cases they do because it's too dangerous to do themselves, and that's the same case in space. When it's too dangerous or the unknowns are too high, you use robots as precursors, and maybe you have to end up, like on Venus, for a very long time, if not forever, having robots do all the work. But where you can put human beings on the ground to do your experimentation for you, to do your observing, and to apply experience and training to the selection of samples and other observations, then there is tremendous benefit to doing that. All you have to do is objectively look at what we gain from the approximately... I'd say about one-third of the Apollo budget that can be legitimately assigned to exploration and not to the politics of the Cold War. And we gained a first-order understanding of another planet, a planet that chemically is very much like our own, and most importantly, from understanding the early history of the Earth, the Moon records the impact history of the solar system during all of the 4.5 billion years of the history of the solar system, and particularly the intense bombardment that occurred in the terrestrial planets, including the Earth, during the first 800 million years or so, a period in which life was, and the precursors to life, were beginning to form here on our planet. So, and we now understand that. We don't understand everything we would like to yet, and that's one of the great benefits of going back. But still, we have perspectives now about the early history of the Earth that could not have been gotten any other way. And that is probably the greatest benefit of scientific benefit of the Earth. We also have as because of the understanding of the moon from Apollo and the robotic follow-on missions that used Apollo as the ground truth for their calibration of their observations, we are now able to ask questions about other robotic exploration on Mars, Venus, and elsewhere that we wouldn't have thought of asking without that database, that primary base of the Apollo understanding. So the science has been profound, and it is very, very long and much more detailed than what I have just given you. And I haven't even mentioned the fact that we discovered an energy resource on the moon that may be, namely helium-3, being present there in sizable quantities, an energy resource that is potentially going to serve the Earth for many centuries into the future. All of this came at a very modest overall cost, and came as an indirect consequence of a politically motivated Cold War initiative that John Kennedy and people don't realize how much involved Dwight Eisenhower was in laying the groundwork for Apollo, but the two of them realized that space was going to be an arena of human competition, and that we had to play in that arena. And the benefits that I talked about scientifically are an indirect benefit that comes from that, along with the things that you talked about and written about that relate to our overall economy. Now, I have persuaded the science committee and the council, NASA Advisory Council, to conduct a lunar science workshop in February, March next year for the council to begin the council's process of understanding the broad range of science opportunities that come as a consequence of the vision for space exploration. Again, the vision for space exploration has as its motivations national policy far beyond science, but science can be a player and benefit as much, but probably more, since we know more from that vision than it did from the vision of John Kennedy and Dwight Eisenhower relative to Apollo.
I want to shift again because I've got a sort of a comprehensive email from Barbara in Tucson, and I think that this is a good set of questions. Barbara says, I'm wondering if there are reasonable alternatives to lunar helium-3, such as space solar power and zero-point energy. Also, I'm curious, do you think we should be drilling for more oil and gas right now to solve our energy problems, despite environmental group objections? And my understanding is that coal plants are the dirtiest of all the energy-generating plants, even dirtier than nuclear power plants. What is your take on that?
Well, that's a lot of stuff to take. First, let's start from the back, from the end and work back and see if I can remember. First of all, nuclear power plants are not dirty. They're the cleanest power plants that we can have. Other than the issue, which the government continues to fumble, of waste, of taking care of the spent fuel rods, the waste from fusion power plants, you can't ask for a cleaner source of electricity than nuclear power plants. It unfortunately suffers from the World War II reputation of having been a bomb, and that. And people just, when they hear nuclear, they get very concerned. But engineering has steadily improved the safety of these plants. I think it's too bad that we cannot get people to understand just how clean and how safe these plants are, relative to coal certainly, and relative to almost any other source of energy. The coal power plants are continually cleaning their effluents. The one effluent that is very difficult to get rid of, but there are obviously solutions being thought, and that is the carbon dioxide effluent, But people are looking at ways to fix carbon dioxide in various ways, so maybe even that will start to disappear. But the particle effluents and the sulfur effluents are steadily declining as a result of both economic and federal regulatory policy. One thing that people have to remember is that every coal bed has a different amount of sulfur, for example, and will have a different amount of radioactive material in it and things like that. And they have to be dealt with, I think, on a case-by-case basis. That's not always the case in regulatory policy. Regulatory policy tends to throw a blanket over everything and damn the consequences. And where Western coal, for example, is very low sulfur, it is burdened with many restrictions that should only apply to Eastern coal, which is high sulfur. And those are just technical issues that the more people who understand them, the better, but are going to have to be dealt with in other fora besides this one. The satellite solar power systems, and particularly those that involve using lunar materials for solar cells and the like, certainly are a viable concept to be looked at. I think that in the final analysis, there will be some environmental and economic issues, more importantly economic issues, that will make those power systems less competitive than lunar helium-3 power. But again, the marketplace is where those things will be determined. And I wish them well in their development of these concepts, and we'll just see how investors start to respond ultimately to the risk involved, financial and otherwise, and to see if any of us can attract the kind of investment we need in order to get started.
What are your thoughts on the other part of her question, which would be maximizing our oil and gas drilling for the short term?
Well, in the near term, because of the political situation in the Middle East, the United States should be trying to get as close to independent or secure energy sources as we can. And one of those, again, remains oil and gas. It's our ace in the hole for dealing with the current geopolitical system situation. And I think we're very foolish in not tapping the resources we can so that we reduce the leverage that these fascist dictators in the Middle East have over our national policies.
Well, I think you're a little polite there, but this is radio. But I totally concur with you completely. Marshall has this question for you. Most of the tokamaks built in the 70s through the 90s are very large room-sized plants. Your book implies smaller fusion reactors. Smaller reactors would probably be far more useful than the big ones. How small do you think a fusion reactor could eventually be?
Well, the electrostatic devices that we're working on at Wisconsin would have no... I think the thing to imagine is that they would have no large magnets associated with them. They'd have to be shielded because they do produce X-rays. But that's very easy to do. You just build concrete around them, and that stops the X-rays. A 1,000-megawatt plant would also not need to have the turbine systems to convert heat to power, because we would be converting the protons to electricity within the reactors themselves. Almost certainly... this will turn out the reactor walls will be lined with the solid-state converters that will give you very high efficiency of conversion of positively charged particles into electricity. And we've got a grad student working on that very problem right now at Wisconsin. So you would eliminate the big magnets, you would eliminate the turbine power conversion systems. And so if you can imagine in your mind a large normal power plant here on Earth, you would have major parts of that missing, and you just wouldn't have to build them. That's one of the reasons why the capital costs of these electrostatically based fusion power plants will certainly be much less than anything involving tokamaks.
Question for you from Donald in Evanston, Illinois. And he says, Dr. Schmidt, obviously you have the ear of NASA and other influential policymakers. Can't you? You're laughing at that. Well,
they have their ear. I don't have their mind yet sometimes.
Well, maybe that address is addressed by this question. Can't you get them to focus on going to the moon for our energy and other commercial benefits, for the economic benefits that will flow and support Americans all through this country and our educational systems? This would bulletproof the political funding for the program, which is probably right now the biggest risk to the Vision program, in that it may not survive the next president or even a change in Congress. What do you think?
Well, it's that is the biggest challenge I think that the Bush administration and the NASA administrator have, is to gain enough momentum for this project, both technical as well as understanding momentum, that it will go through the 2008 elections. And the best thing we can do, I can do, and others can do, is to try to make things move as fast and rationally as possible towards showing that this indeed not only is technically feasible, but it has these other potentials. You know, even though the government, the U.S. government, is not talking about lunar energy resources in their rationale for the Vision for Space Exploration. They're talking about resources, but not specifically talking about lunar energy resources. Even though that's not happening, the point is that they're moving in the direction of helping build a technology base that would let it happen. nothing right now that the government's doing with respect to the Vision of Exploration, except maybe not moving as fast as we would like, is going to hurt, I think, ultimately, a commercially-based enterprise. I don't see it hurting that at all. It may not be the way that I would have done outside of NASA, but it still is helpful.
Of course.
And I can't... I can't see any argument against it other than its pace. Pace is determined by funding, and that's up to the Congress.
Well, and of course, what Donald is saying is, if the American people understood what you're talking about and what others are talking about, and understood the direct economic benefit that this means to their future, their kids' education, their own welfare, they'd be pressuring Congress to fund this program, to expedite it, to speed it up. They don't want to be held hostage to the Middle East potentates for our policies and everything that we're doing. But these connections to the dots are not being made.
Well, that's one reason. That's the primary reason I wrote the book, is that maybe we can get a few more people to connect the dots and talk to their congressmen and senators.
Oh, boy, that's why I do this show. Terry, known as Space Cowboy back in Dallas, Texas, says, what about ethanol to help waylay our need for oil and solar towers for energy? Do you think they're helpful?
Well, let's talk about two aspects of ethanol. One is the current situation. It is very difficult in the current cradle of the grave analysis of ethanol from corn, primarily, and that is being touted in the Midwest so much. It is very difficult to show that, certainly without a subsidy, that there is any net benefit in using ethanol. It is lower efficiency. It takes a lot of energy to produce, and that energy has to come from somewhere else, and it lowers your gas mileage and the like. It just, when you do the cradle-to-grave analysis, it's hard, absent a subsidy, it's hard to show that there's any, that the economics hold water. Now, can you improve the situation? I think you can, and I happen to be a director of a company that is trying to do that by genetically engineering the biomass component that goes into ethanol, so that you get a much higher efficiency in the production of the ethanol. and that improve the economics that way. If we can do that, then I think ethanol can play a significant, although not a great role, but a significant role at about the maybe max 8 to 10% of our portable fuel needs in this country. And it is homegrown, and you can't sniff at percentages of even that of that size. So I work in ethanol. this company is called Eden Space, and they are beginning to put together a way in which the efficiency in the use of switchgrass and the use of corn and other biomass components can be increased, so that ethanol will start to make real economic sense and not just political sense. It obviously makes political sense in the grain belt, but the economic sense is not yet demonstrated.
We're getting close to the program today, to the end of the program today. So, first of all, if people have follow-up questions or comments, do you want to give them a way to contact you, or would you prefer they go through me and I forward the notes?
They go through you, and you can sort them out. And if there's some that you think need to be responded to, don't hesitate to send them to me by email, and I'll do my best.
Okay. And the other thing is, what would you like to say to listeners today? Your sort of concluding thoughts, pearls of wisdom.
Well, I think people ought to make sure that they keep their eye on the future as well as the very, very serious issues of the present, and that just be very parochial about the United States, and that we need to develop a very long-term energy independence, and also develop a new market for our technology and our products as we look into the next 10 to 20 years, and lunar helium 3 can be part of that. There will be other parts of that that have to be in the total mix. When you start to look at the size of the rate of growth of the world population, and the fact that four-fifths of them live in far worse conditions than we can even imagine, energy is going to be a major, major part of finding solutions to those the problems that they face, and to eliminating the stresses that those problems bring to the world as a whole, and the United States in particular. So space plays a very, very important role in the future in potentially solving some of these very fundamental problems. It also plays an extraordinarily important role in education. The young people are very excited about space. All you have to do is go into the school system to find that out. And it can not only be an advantage to the intellectual development of all children, but it will be an extraordinary advantage to what this country needs to do to stay a viable nation and culture for an indefinite period of time in the future.
I have one final question that came in. I'll see if I can get it in. And this is from Becky in Boston. And she said, is energy, in your opinion, the primary reason we should be putting our resources into a manned space program right now, or just one of the top two or three primary reasons? Is if it's just one of the top two or three, what would be the other reasons that would be equal in importance and value to energy?
I would say that it is the number one reason why we need to be interested in the moon today. We need as many alternatives as we possibly can develop to meet the kind of demand that I outline in my book. That demand is in the future to just meet the aspirations of the so-called third world, fourth world, for improved standards of living that maybe were comparable to ours. Would take 10 times the amount of energy that we have available to us on Earth today. And so it's going to not only going to take helium-3, it's going to take a whole bunch of other alternatives as we look to see how we can remove that, at least that source of tension on Earth. There'll be other sources of tension, as we're seeing now in the religious basis of problems in the Middle East. But nevertheless, that's one we can do something about. And space will play a role in that, no question about it.
Space Show listeners, Dr. Harrison Schmidt's book, Return to the Moon, I cannot recommend it more strongly. I've read every word in it. It is a great book. It will be a fabulous resource for you. It outlines project management requirements, capital acquisition requirements. It balances trade-offs. It goes into economic analysis. It is objective, despite our guests' total preferences for Lunar Helium 3. Buy it, read it, and I promise you, you will learn from it. Dr. Schmidt, I want to thank you very much for being a guest on The Space Show. Listeners, on behalf of our guest today, thanks for tuning in. Remember, our next program, due to the Labor Day holiday, is Monday morning, 9:30 a.m. California time, with Baron Soka. We're not doing a Sunday show because of Labor Day. Thank you all, and goodbye from The Space Show.